tell you all that this month celebrates 10 years of interfaith guest presenters that came to Interfaith Community Church. And it actually is a model for other communities. We've been doing this for a long time, but other communities began to also know, experience, learn, and model what we have done here, which is the best way to learn about another faith tradition is to just sit in the presence of and listen. So we are so delighted that Stephen is here today. And I would like to invite Corinne to offer a special introduction of Stephen, if you would. Corinne knows him very well personally, even though she's sitting way over here. And we know this is a surprise, but would you like to say a word?
Sure. Good morning, everyone. I was prepared for this. So this is a spontaneous introduction. And I've known Steve for years and witnessed from a friendship his growth in spirituality. And I've also actually been in the audience when I was a younger woman, when I lived in Spokane, and his rock and roll band used to come to I think Steve has an incredible gift to meld different worlds together. And I think that as I've grown, that's been a particular challenge for me. I think that sometimes our culture doesn't support a spiritual path and of our own making, anyway. And I think that Steve is very adept at that. And it's just wonderful to see him stand up and share that. And so I think we're all lucky today.
Now, wasn't that perfect?
Thank you. trustees says, now is the time to know that all that you do is sacred. Now is the time to understand that all your ideas of right and wrong were just a child's training wheels, to be laid aside when you finally live with veracity and love. Hafiz is a divine envoy upon whom the beloved has written a holy message. Please tell me, my dear, why is it you still throw sticks at your heart and God? What is it in that sweet voice inside that incites you to fear? Now is the time for the world to know that every thought and action is sacred. This is the time to compute the impossibility that there is anything but grace. This is the time to compute the impossibility that there is anything but grace. Now is the time to know that everything you do is sacred. That was a poem by Hafiz, who's a wonderful poet and just so living today, and one of my very favorites, a real poet of joy. And he lived in the 14th century in Shiraz in Persia, which is now Iran. And he's known as a Sufi mystic poet. And so today we're going to be talking about the sacred and the profane. And so I looked up the word profane just to make sure I sort of really knew what I was talking about. And it was interesting, I discovered that the roots of the word from the Latin pro, meaning before, and faro, meaning temple. It means outside the temple. So it's usually thought of as, you know, the secular, the sacred and profane, the secular and sacred, but profara, outside the temple. And it's interesting, the Sufis have an idea of the work in the world as work in the world. Their spiritual work takes place outside the temple. There's no separation between their spiritual life and the work that they do and the work that they do in the world. They're out every minute, every action, every thought, every encounter with a human being is part of that work, is part of the sacred work, and it takes place outside the temple. So that would fit in with the profane. I'm a musician and have really been blessed. I'm really grateful. I've been able to make a living at it pretty much for most of my life. And I've played in hundreds of bar rooms for thousands of people dancing and drinking. And I've also had a great opportunity to play for sacred events as well, particularly for the last about 14 years I've been playing for the Mevlevi dervishes, the whirling dervishes. And one of the main instruments they use in the music for that is this, which is called a ney, and it's a very ancient Middle Eastern flute. And Rumi, the poet, the 12th century Sufi mystic poet, uses this as a metaphor for the human being in a lot of his poems. And I particularly like this one because it reminds me, it's made of plastic. This is PVC. Generally, they're made of this Dorindo cane, this beautiful cane that grows out of the ground, which is, of course, a wonderful natural plant. But there's something about this PVC, and just to remind me, I even left the barcode on that you can take this piece of plastic that's worth about a dime, and under the proper conditions, music, beautiful music, can come out of it. And again, in sort of uniting the sacred and profane, we have Home Depot aiding a sacred practice and aiding, helping people come to a particular state. Another so one thing, speaking of coming to a particular state, right now I'd like to do a practice, and it's a practice that some of you are very familiar with. And it's, I love it because, again, it's so outside the temple. It's so, it's something that, that everyone does every day, practically, I'd be willing to bet. And people don't think of it as a spiritual practice, but it's part, it's just part of who we are, and it's part of what we do. And it's along with laughter and crying, it's actually one of the languages of the heart, and it's the sigh. And it's so beautiful, and it's so powerful, because it can, it, the sigh can actually, it can change your state. It can move you from one state to another. And Hazrat Inayat Khan was a Sufi teacher who's known as the man who brought Sufism to the West. He came from India in 1910 and brought a wonderful message that's continued on. And he said of the sigh, he said it can do two things. One is it can wash your heart of the impressions. Every day we have impressions that come from life onto our heart and kind of stick on the surface of our heart. Someone, you may have a conversation with someone, maybe they roll their eyes at you and a little piece sticks on your heart. Or you see some beautiful flowers, you know, from the outside, and some of that comes in on the surface of your heart. And eventually the surface of your heart can become a little cloudy with some of these impressions that come from the outside world, and it gets harder to see and to hear what's coming from the inside. And so one of the things the sigh can do is wash those impressions, just wash your heart and maintain some more, some clarity. And the other thing Hazrat Inayat Khan said it could do is it can open the door to another world, to the unseen world. It can open the door in your heart. So if you'd like to join me, I'd more than welcome you. If you don't feel like it, that's absolutely fine. Nothing worse than doing a spiritual practice that you don't really want to do. It's not, not a spiritual practice. On the other hand, things that you love to do, even unidentified as spiritual practices, can be spiritual practices because you're bringing your love to them. So we'll sigh. We'll do it three times because in fairy tales, they always do things three times. It seems to work out pretty well. So if you'll join me, just let it go. Yes, you can just feel that relaxation and that shift. One more time. As you change, you can feel the quality of the side change. I'll do it one more time. That helps me. So I have a bit of my story. I was raised in a household that practiced Christian Science, and we studied every day, and it was a part, it was a living religion, it was part of our lives, and we tried to demonstrate that in our lives. And I'll preface this by saying that I'm going to tell you about my experience with the religion when I was like 11 or 12, and this is my experience, and everyone has different experiences and different things, different paths resonate, and sometimes they resonate at a certain time of life and not another time of life, and there's all kinds of levels of teaching and stuff. So I'm not really saying anything particularly about the religion itself or the teachings. I'm saying what my experience was with this particular piece. So when I was a child, I grew up, and I resonate with it. It's a very, it's metaphysical religion, very consciousness oriented, and I was kind of a mental kid, so that sort of fit. But one of the main tenets was this very simple statement, that God is all. God is all. And I love that. That resonated, and that, you know, was kind of foreshadowed later on when, you know, I started looking into Sufism. There's a similar thing. It's like God is all. It's all. There isn't anything outside of the presence of the divine. So I love that. Another main tenet came from this piece called The Scientific Statement of Being, and it said, there is no life, truth, intelligence, nor substance in matter. All is infinite mind, and its infinite manifestation, for God is all in all. Spirit is the real and eternal. Matter is the unreal and temporal. And it goes on, and you get the idea that, that, you know, it was oriented towards the spirit, and really was saying there is no life, truth, intelligence, no substance in matter. And when I was about 11 or 12, you know, coming into my body and sort of prepubescent and stuff, it started occurring to me. I said, well, there's a little logical disconnect here for me. If God is all, then what's the problem with matter? I mean, this looks pretty good. There's some, you know, there's flowers and my body's great, you know, it feels good. And so that was for me, you know, and I stayed with in studying that religion for a number of more years, but it was the beginning of a questioning and probably the piece that I was really not able to resonate with after a certain point, and I left that, was the idea that somehow God was not in matter, that this material existence was not somehow included and was somehow to be, you know, put aside in some sort of way. I just didn't feel right to me. And later on, actually a few years ago, I went back to school and I studied sciences I'd never studied before. I studied chemistry and biology and anatomy and physiology. And I was just amazed. I was so opened up. I mean, do you have any idea what's going on in all our bodies at this very moment? I mean, if you're looking for a miracle, there's a million miracles that happen in your body every minute, you know? You have 70 million cells in there, and each little cell has a greater sort of technological intelligence than a Boeing 747. You know, it's doing amazing stuff. And we're not telling it what to do. You don't have to think about that, you know. It's just all going on, and it's all going on everywhere. And it's just, to me, it's such a miracle, and it really feels that you can get this feeling of being part of this whole process. The process unites us. There's something going on here in the physical world that's miraculous and unites us. And then that's only what we know about. And think of all the things that we don't, and the connection between this world and the unseen world. And it's just, I mean, it goes on and on, and it's amazing. So Rumi was another wonderful poet, mystic poet from the 13th century. And Rumi says, I am dust particles in sunlight. I am the round sun. To the bits of dust I say, stay. To the sun, keep moving. I am the morning mist and the breathing of evening. Wind at the top of a grove and surf on the cliff. Mast, rudder, helmsman, and keel. I am also the coral reef they founder on. I am a tree with a talking parrot in its branches. I am silence, thought, and voice. The musical air through a flute, the spark of a stone, a flickering in metal. Both candle and the moth crazy around it. Rose and the nightingale lost in its fragrance. I am all orders of being, the whirling galaxies, the evolutionary intelligence, the lifting up and the falling away. Both what is and what isn't. You who know me, you who know Jalaluddin, say who I am. You who know me, you the one in all things, say who I am. Say I am you. So there's a wonderful teacher, Rev. Solomon Schachter, who is a rabbi. He's in his 80s, an incredible human being. You meet this man and his countenance is just glowing. His face just radiates. His eyes are amazing. Beautiful human. And he's a rabbi, and he says when he counsels young, you know, boys that are going in to be bar mitzvah, you know, and there's some counseling that goes on. And he says, you know, one of the things you want to be sure is that you do not shut God out of any part of your life. So when you masturbate, it's okay, but you need to invite God to be there. You need to not shut God out of it. And the point is, it's interesting because the question is, you know, it's where do we separate the divine out in our life? Where do we say, okay, it's not here, or I don't even want it here. I don't want God to see this, or I don't feel in my heart that this is really part of, this shouldn't be happening, you know. This is something that should not be part of this life, you know. And it's easy to look at, you know, daffodils coming out in the spring, and it's like, oh yes, the divine is there, it's so beautiful. Or the smile of a baby, and it's just, you know, they're just wonderful and sacred. And you're on the 520 bridge, absolutely stuck in traffic, you're late for an appointment, and you have to go to the bathroom. So it's harder, you know, that it's harder to see that moment as a sacred moment. That moment being within, you know, the whole the piece of divinity. So it's an interesting practice, and I was going to do it, but I'm probably going to go on too long anyway, so we can take this home. But it's an interesting practice to sit and think, where really do I, you know, what do I separate out? What in my life do I look at and say, you know, that's not sacred, or that shouldn't be part of this life, or, you know, there's something wrong with this, or this is, I don't want God to be any part of this. Where are those things in life? And man, it's interesting what comes up for us. And it's interesting then to open and say, well, what would happen if I turned that around? What would happen if I invited God to be there with me, you know, when I'm doing something I don't want anybody to know about? Or what would happen if I could, you know, be stuck in traffic and, you know, shaking my fist at the other drivers and all of a sudden see, well, there, you know, we're connected, you know, this is all part of the same process. We're just all in this together. So Rumi says, this being human is a guest house. This being human is a guest house. Every morning, a new arrival, a joy, a depression, a meanness. Some momentary awareness comes as an unexpected visitor. Welcome and entertain them all. Even if it's a crowd of sorrows that violently sweeps your house empty of its furniture, still, treat each guest honorably. He may be clearing you up for some new delight. The dark thought, the shame, the malice. Greet them at the door laughing and invite them in. Be grateful for whoever comes. Be grateful for whoever comes because each has been sent as a guide from beyond. Sometimes what comes knocking is the blues. And we have, you know, there's situations in life that tell you, you know, you don't want this situation. This is not a good thing. There's things that definitely don't feel like something we want. And this arrives, and, you know, sometimes the blues are there. And in American music, you know, in the South, there's a real split between the church music and the blues music. If you played gospel in church, you didn't play the blues. And if you played the blues, you didn't go to church, and you didn't play church music, and they were very separate. Interesting, because they came from the same root of African music, which we'll talk about a little bit more later. But but they were really kept separate for a long time until, I don't know if you've seen this wonderful movie Ray about Ray Charles, where he's at one point in his career, he's playing this new song for his future wife, who is a very devout church lady, and you know, and he starts playing, starts singing, he says, "I got a woman way over town, she's good to me, oh yeah." And she's going, "Ray, Ray, Ray, stop, stop, what are you doing?" And she said, and he said, "What?" He said, she said, "That's gospel, that's church music. You can't do that. You can't put those lyrics and do that to gospel music." And he said, "I know what it is, I wrote it." And he, and he, you know, part of his genius was he did that. He combined, he brought them back together, the gospel and the blues, and lit up a lot of people's hearts in that process. And the blues can, again, can be a very powerful spiritual practice, because in singing that, you can it changes your state. It changes your perception, changes your relationship to the events you're singing about, and thus, and changing your perception and changing your state. So you can come into it in a state of despair, and then with that music, you can shift that state to something else. Doesn't change the situation, but it changes your relationship to it. So, blues.
I won't be blue all day.
sometimes that gets pushed even a little further, and the profane seems to become the obscene. And there's parts of life that are just so difficult that you can fall into a questioning state. And at least for me, there was a situation in 1999 that the war in Kosovo was going on, and there was just, I was following it in the news, and there was horrible things going on. And, you know, Albanian civilians were getting massacred, and people were being pushed out, run out of their homes, and it was bad, you know. And I was just, and it was just going on, and I was just, I don't know, it really hurt, and I was bewildered, you know, that this could even be occurring. And then, right after some of the worst of that, in April of 99, the Columbine shootings occurred. And then, you know, children, murdering children. And it kind of pushed me over some sort of edge, and I got real dark. And I was just, you know, filled with such questioning and such doubt. And I was thinking, well, this whole beautiful, miraculous universe, maybe it's just a big empty space with like explosions happening here and there, now and then, you know, it's just empty space and things exploding, and that's pretty much big accident, and that's what's going on. And I got, it was very hard internal period for me. And I started writing this song that was coming up to kind of express some of this questioning and some of this anger and some of this feeling, and I got two verses done and was singing them, and it was expressed it, but it didn't help much. It didn't resolve anything. And then at some point, as I worked with it, a last verse came that kind of, again, didn't change the situation, but changed my perspective on it. And this is that song. Called Can We Call the Angels Down? I kind of thought of it as my dark gospel song. Stormy ocean swirls around a sailor. this world. We're not held in God's bucket. How could the ocean stand upside down on its head and never lose a drop? If your life were not contained in God's cup, how could you be so brave to laugh and dance in the face of death? Hafiz, there is a private chamber deep in the soul that holds a great secret of which no tongue can speak. Your existence, my dear, oh love, my dear, your very existence has been sealed and marked by the beloved, too sacred to ever end. Indeed, God has written 1,000 promises all over your heart that say life, life, life is far too sacred to ever end. So, one of my passions in life is New Orleans rhythm and blues music. There's something about this music that just touches moves me so deeply, and there's something about this music. So much American music came from New Orleans, and so one year I decided to make a little kind of a little pilgrimage down there, and there were three spots I wanted to see, and one was Professor Longhair's grave, and Professor Longhair was an incredible, wonderful New Orleans piano player, and the second was the site of Cosimos Matassa's recording studio, and this Greek guy had this recording studio in the late 40s through the 50s and the 60s that recorded some of the very first rock and roll music. He recorded the first Fats Domino sides and the first Little Richard cuts and on and on. All kinds of amazing music was done in this very humble little studio in New Orleans. And the third place I wanted to see was Congo Square. And Congo Square is in a park in the middle of New Orleans, and now they have a beautiful kind of brown mosaic there. And what happened there is in the middle 1700s, 1750s to the 1780s, I'm not sure when it started, but you know there were slaves, and these slaves had brought from Africa, they brought their rituals, and their rituals included music and dance. And in the part of it was in this dance, the deity would be embodied. It was a celebration of the deity in the body. And some of the slave owners, they didn't want to let them celebrate these rituals, you know, off by themselves because they could conspire and, you know, who knows what would happen. But some very discerning person also realized that if they just said, no, you can't do this, it would create a pressure that, you know, eventually could erupt in some other way, and that, you know, they really needed to be able to allow to, you know, do this expression. So Tony had the great idea. He said, well, what we'll do is we'll have it in public. And so in Congo Square on Sunday afternoons, they would let the slaves go and do their sacred ritual, their dance and music in Congo Square in the middle of town, and the white people would come and watch. And it was actually the first, as far as I know, you know, sort of public performance of African American music for a white audience. And what was interesting was they were performing ritual, you know, they were, you know, invoking the deity, and it was a sacred practice. And the people that were watching, it was a performance. And it was interesting. It was a curiosity. But those who witness sacred ritual, there is an energy there that moves across. There's not really necessarily a boundary there. So that energy moved out into that audience. So I went down there, and I was looking at a map trying to find these places, and I found Congo Square. It was easy. It was labeled. It was right on the map. And then I looked up the address that I had for Cosimo Matassa's original recording studio, and when I saw it on the map, my hair stood up. I got chicken flesh because it was across the street from Congo Square. It was literally across the street from Congo Square. And what that meant to me was, you know, 200 years after, you know, this first celebration and performance of African American sacred music, 200 years later, across the street, the flowering of that same music happened in a way that then opened this great, you know, was, I think, instrumental in opening this great social revolution where, you know, white kids, you know, became aware of the deity in their bodies, and people started dancing, and people started, you know, celebrating their bodies more, and a lot of the things cracked open, and from that music, and it was just interesting. It feels to me like there was a sacred thread that, you know, through, I mean, Lord knows, lots of pain and suffering, but this thread came through all that from the 1700s, you know, and before, through Congo Square, and then 200 years later across the street to where this music was recorded that then went out into the world and, you know, and changed the world. So in celebration of the embodied deity, I'd like you to all participate if you choose in this last song and get up and dance and celebrate the divine, or you can just shake it, you know, however it feels right. And this is the boogie woogie, and there's something about the boogie woogie. I've played boogie woogie for hundreds of people, and there's something in that music that just does something, you know, just people. And and I think maybe we're going to do the offertory while this is going on. So it'll be a big piece. But before that, I'd like to do this one last Hafiz poem, which is one of my absolute favorite. Hafiz says, every child has known God. Every child has known God. Not the God of words. Not the God of don'ts. Thou shalt not. Not the God that ever does anything weird, but the God that only knows four words and keeps repeating them, saying, come dance with me. Come dance with me. Come dance. The name of this tune is the Boogie Woogie Prayer. I don't know how it got that name, but that's what it's called. It's by Albert Ammons. Thank you. It wasn't, I don't know. Well.
You can refuse us too, but.
Well, then, okay, everyone, I haven't practiced, so we'll just, but there was another, there's a piece, you know, in terms of the sacred and profane, you know, it's interesting, a lot of songs, love songs and stuff, you can listen to the very same lyrics, and if you think about it being addressed to the divinity, I mean, it works just fine. I was in a group we used to, on Saturday nights, it was a spiritual group, but on Saturday nights we danced to soul music, to Motown. And you can listen to any of those songs, and they're about soul, you know, they're about divinity and stuff. And this is a tune that I started writing as a romantic love song. At one point I realized, I said, this actually is a devotional song. So, it's called River of Love, and I guess I haven't. Anyway, we'll just see what happens here.
Thank you.
closing, and then we can all rejoin downstairs. And for those who've come to collect your tickets, I will have them for you downstairs.